I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Outrage over the death of George Floyd is spreading across the globe. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said Canadians are watching in horror at what's happening in the United States. And protests have broken out on the streets of London and Berlin and as far away as New Zealand.
And here in this country, presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden gave a speech in Philadelphia today addressing the escalating unrest in the U.S. And President Trump signed an executive order on religious freedom after that photo op at a historic D.C. church yesterday, where police and the National Guard dispersed protesters with tear gas and flash grenades to clear the way for the president. NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro joins us now. Domenico, Biden spoke in Philadelphia today. He addressed the protests sparked by George Floyd's death. Let's listen.
A country is crying out for leadership. Leadership that can unite us. Leadership that brings us together. Leadership that can recognize pain and deep grief of communities that have had a knee on their neck for a long time.
Domenico, tell us more about what Biden said today.
Well, grief, you know, is really one of those sweet spots for Joe Biden. He wrote a whole book about his, you know, aftermath with the death of his son, Beau. And he talks a lot about in that book, and he talked a lot about today, finding purpose. It reminds me of a very Catholic sort of way of looking at death and morbidity and trying to find some hope through that. He's trying to strike this balance. You know, he criticized President Trump speaking out for racial justice and action going forward, the need for that, but disapproving of the violent demonstrations. And that's a tough balance to strike. And, you know, it was a pretty strong speech. His critiques for Trump were really about him holding up the Bible. At one point he said that, you know, he held up the Bible and I wished he'd read it once in a while.
Mm. Well, what about that? The scene last night with the Attorney General, William Barr, standing there in front of the cameras, waiting for this moment to happen where the National Guard troops charge forward at peaceful protesters outside the White House to clear the way for President Trump to do a photo op at this church. How are people reacting in Washington?
Yeah, it was really an astonishing moment. I mean, conservatives who the president, you know, has retweeted and who have been deeply in his camp, you know, certainly are praising him and saying that they thought this was a good idea. But there's not much beyond that. There are a lot of things that this president has done, but this could be one of those searing moments. I mean, to clear peaceful protesters with smoke bombs, to take a photo in front of a church with a Bible is something else altogether. Local officials, religious leaders have condemned what he did yesterday. We know that the president is looking at his own reelection poll numbers. He's looking at the fact that older voters have come down somewhat for him. Evangelical voters, people inside the White House are concerned that with his handling of the coronavirus pandemic, that he may be losing some of them, that he's had some softening with some core groups. And one thing that this president has always done is declare himself the law and order candidate. And he believes taking that hard line can help him draw a wedge with those moderate whites who disapprove of the way Minneapolis police knelt on the neck of George Floyd in that video and were outraged by that, but at the same time disapproving of those violent protests.
Well, some also believe that he is trying to take attention away from what's going on with the coronavirus pandemic, which, of course, has not gone away, even as many states have started to open up a bit more. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the leader in terms of the health experts for the White House on this pandemic, said yesterday he hasn't spoken to Trump in 2 weeks. What do you make of that?
You know, I mean, coronavirus hasn't gone away. I mean, you know, we have seen declines in a lot of states, but clearly a very long plateau. The United States now over 105,000 deaths in this country, leading the world in the number of deaths from coronavirus. You know, it's a very dangerous position for the United States and for the U.S. president to be in when you don't have a vaccine, you don't have a known or proven treatment. The White House believes that the number of cases will go down over the summer months because of the warmth. That's a guess. But that potentially could mean that people, you know, get lax on social distancing measures. And if they were to do that, you could see a spike and a spike in the fall. And if you still don't have a vaccine, which, you know, look, Dr. Fauci had said that he's a little disappointed with the way, for example, Moderna put out their data earlier this year about it. And You know, it's there's nothing there that's set in stone that's going to get the country back to normal, so to speak. You know, and I think that these protests and violent clashes have really clouded that.
NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro, thank you.
You're welcome.
Four officers were injured in St. Louis, Missouri overnight during what became a violent protest. The officers are expected to recover, but during a press conference with reporters, Police Chief John Hayden became emotional while addressing the crowd.
Some coward fired shots at officers, and now we have four in the hospital. But thankfully, and thank God, they're alive. But can we make some sense out of this? That's all I'm trying to say.
Joining us now is KMOV reporter Justin Andrews in St. Louis. Welcome.
Thank you so much. So glad to be here. Wish it was under better circumstances, but here we are.
I know. Yeah. Andrew, you were there last night. Please describe what you saw and heard happen.
Yeah, it was wild. Honestly, I've been reporting for about 10 years almost, and it was something that I'd never seen before. I got a call around 12:30 this morning from my executive producer, and she goes, Justin, we need you to come in. Four officers were shot in the city of St. Louis. Instantly, immediately, I asked her the question, is this related to the looting and the violence we've seen over the last 3 to 4 days at this point? She goes, yes. So packed up my gear with our security team and my photographer, came to this area called North City, North St. Louis City. It was chaos. Typically we report on crimes that happened hours before. We were seeing these crimes unfolding on our air.
Oh, and what were you seeing?
We were seeing people running into these buildings, stealing merchandise, taking huge items of shoes, stealing TVs from walls of these small businesses, busting out windows. It was just so chaotic. And then not far, a good distance away, we could see a group of people, at least 24 individuals around an ATM trying to get money out of the ATM. So much so, they used a van to try to ram into the ATM to try to get the money out. All of this literally unfolding while we're on the air. It was just indescribable.
What do you know about the four officers who were injured, and what are their conditions?
So the four officers injured were told they were actually basically protecting the area and keeping order in downtown St. Louis. It was an area kind of in the hub of downtown St. Louis. They were out there just basically standing around. Suddenly, boom, gunshots ring out. I believe their injuries range from legs, arms, you know, things like that. Nothing serious.
Yeah. Do you know if there are any arrests that have happened?
We don't. We have not gotten those numbers from police just yet, at least from overnight. We have gotten a couple of arrests in other parts of the metropolitan St. Louis area from other nights. But as of right now, we have not gotten any numbers when it comes to arrests. But I don't even know if they were even trying to last night, because it was they had gotten so many calls of break-ins, of fires, of looting, of all of this. So I'm not sure if they even had the manpower to even try to arrest these individuals. In fact, the security guard who was with us, who is a police officer with another department, he stopped some looting. There were two women who ran into this clothing store trying to loot. And he said, hey, stop. So those are the situations that's been unfolding since about 1:30 this morning, at least from my eyes. They actually started way before.
You know, St. Louis holds significance because it borders Ferguson, Missouri, and that's, of course, a place that sparked a wave of protests after the shooting death of Michael Brown. You are a journalist working in this city, and you live there. What is the sense you're getting from residents there and police about this moment that we're in, and really those longstanding concerns communities there have had about police interaction?
It's very bad here in St. Louis. We see a divide racially. And it's really kind of reflective of across the country, I guess, recently. But St. Louis, it just takes another situation and it just amplifies. Like you said, happened in Ferguson years ago. These individuals, they've been through this before. And I think this time around, it's a little different because during Ferguson, it appeared that it was new to loot. You know, they were just like, oh, police are over here. We're going to do this. Now the anger seems to be more more violent because they've seen it years ago. They've done it years ago. So now it's like, I don't even care. There's total disregard for life and property. And I really want to make the distinction, though, that protests started peacefully yesterday afternoon, peacefully, by the thousands. And then when night falls, another wave and a different group of individuals come in and cause terror.
That's KMOV reporter Justin Andrews in St. Louis, Missouri. Justin, thank you so much.
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
In Russia, President Vladimir Putin announced this week that July 1st is the new day for a vote that will determine whether he can stay in power until 2036. Yes, I said 2036. The vote was supposed to take place in April, but was delayed by the coronavirus. For more, let's bring in Lucian Kim, NPR's Moscow correspondent. Lucian, Putin wants the ability to have two more six-year terms. Are Russians expected to give it to him?
Well, technically, this is a referendum on a whole raft of constitutional changes, everything from banning gay marriage to officially proclaiming Russians' faith in God. And the amendment letting Putin stay in power for two more terms was actually slipped in at the very last moment, but obviously it's the most important change, and some people would say the real purpose of changing the constitution in the first place. As for whether Russians will vote for these changes, yes, the expectation is that this will be a rubber stamp after the Russian parliament, Russia's 85 regional assemblies, and the constitutional court all approved of them.
Well, is it even safe to vote against Putin or something that he wants in Russia?
Well, nothing happens to you if you don't vote for Putin. The biggest headache for the Kremlin is actually ensuring turnout, and that's why there's a lot of pressure for people getting government salaries or pensions to go out and vote, because these voters are usually the most loyal supporters of the government.
Now, Putin has been in power for two decades, but now Russia is dealing with the two crises that we all face, the coronavirus pandemic, and Russia's been one of the worst hit countries in the world when it comes to that, and the economy. What's the perception of how Putin has handled both of those things?
Well, the main perception is that Putin has been largely absent as a leader. His goal this year has been to push through these constitutional changes, and the coronavirus pandemic really caught him off guard. There's this image of Putin as this all-powerful leader, but in this crisis situation, he's tried to push responsibility for lockdowns onto regional governors and disengage himself from daily politics. He's in a real rush to get these amendments behind him and to end speculation about his political future. And some observers say he wants to have the referendum in July before there's a second wave of the pandemic and before his approval ratings slide anymore.
Now, as we've been watching what's been happening here in the United States with not just the divisions in the country over the handling of the coronavirus and wearing masks, but also now the protests over the death of George Floyd, some people have been commenting saying, well, this is just what Vladimir Putin wants. He loves to see this kind of division in the United States. What do we know about how he feels about what he's seeing in the U.S.?
Well, there's no way that we can look inside Vladimir Putin's head. But I certainly think the Kremlin is pleased when the U.S. is preoccupied with its own problems and taken down a notch or two in its international standing. But officially, Putin's spokesman is saying that the protests in the U.S. are a domestic American issue. I think it's notable that Presidents Trump and Putin spoke on the phone on Monday, and it wasn't the first time they talked since the start of the pandemic. So sure, you know, Putin may not be too unhappy with the developments in the U.S., but he's also trying to use all these crises to improve Russia's standing, and he's doing his best to normalize relations with the U.S. despite everything else happening.
That is NPR's Moscow correspondent, Lucian Kim. Lucian, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as police and protesters have clashed over the last few days in the U.S., videos have shown police tear gassing and attacking peaceful protesters, even journalists. But in Flint, Michigan, police set down their batons as the protesters said, "Walk with us." So Chris Swanson, sheriff of Genesee County, which includes Flint, did just that. And he joins us now. Sheriff, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, and why did you make that decision to walk with the protesters?
You know, I would like to say that it was a planned decision and it was strategic, but it really came from the heart. The intensity was so great. It had been building all week. It had started with 8 minutes and 46 seconds that erased police relations in an instant. And when I felt that tension and they walked up on the line and the two sides were clashing, just like you see around the nation, I just knew that something had to change. I couldn't believe it was happening right there before my very eyes in Flint, who's already been sacrificed and already been challenged so much. So I started seeing one fist pump between the crowd and an officer, and I saw a hug. And that fear started to melt, and I thought, right there is the opportunity. I took off my hat. They put their batons down. I walked into the crowd. I grabbed one of the leaders. I gave him a big old hug, and I said, "Listen, that guy is not who we are." And he said, "Tell the crowd." And then he got their attention, and I addressed the crowd. But the second question, Jeremy, is what really put Flint, Michigan on history, and that is, what do we need to do now? And they said, "Walk with us." And that changed everything.
Well, what do you make then of what we've seen in other cities, in New York, in Washington, D.C., in Los Angeles? We've seen police in some cases act violently toward protesters, in some cases completely unprovoked. You saw what happened last night outside the White House. What's going on? What do you think of what other departments are doing?
Well, I can only answer for what happened that night. And when I say that, it's because we dealt with protesters that had a message. And that message was changed. The folks that are burning cities down that are not theirs, that are going to businesses and looting, they are not the protesters. They are not the ones with the message. Even the Floyd family called out. You can't have lawlessness. I get that. But I'm going to tell you, through time and through healing, we're going to get back. You can already see the change. We can see police agencies across the nation now change philosophies. And I believe those big cities, New York, Washington, L.A., they're going to heal, and it's going to get back to where we want to be.
But what about what authorities have done in many cases? Do you think that authorities have crossed the line and gone too far in trying to tamp down some of what's been happening?
You know, it's hard to see. And when you see images like that and when you see people that are peacefully protesting, because that's a First Amendment right. And whether it's a riot, a demonstration, a protest, or on a traffic stop, you can't take away people's constitutional rights. So individually, if somebody has the intent to hurt and harm in law enforcement, that's how we got here in the first place. We saw somebody on the back of the neck of an individual who had rights. And that act right there brought us to where we are right now. And when you saw the same reports that I did last night, what's happening in New York and in L.A. and D.C., how do you justify what got us there? You can't. You can't. That's not what policing is about. Policing is about protecting and serving.
What about reporters? We've seen CNN reporters arrested on camera. We've seen reporters shot with rubber bullets by police, tear gassed. Why do you think that in so many instances in the last several days, police are going after journalists?
Well, I can tell you this, Jeremy. Throughout our history, we've had journalists on the front lines. The risk that journalists put is as noble as those fighting the front lines. I talked to a reporter yesterday whose own friend was shot in the left eye and blinded by a rubber bullet. That breaks my heart as much as anything else does. So for people to do their job and to be injured, that's no different than a police officer getting injured or a nurse getting injured or what it is. That's a frontline worker. You can't justify that. Certainly, there's no excuse if it was intentional. They're there to tell the story, not to be a victim.
We've heard the president's national security advisor and others in this country say that systemic racism doesn't exist in U.S. law enforcement. That is not what many criminal justice experts and many black people have said. They've pointed to institutionalized racism across the system. What do you think about that? Is there systemic racism in law enforcement?
That's a great question. And I can't agree that it doesn't exist. It's a reality. You saw the frustration. You've seen cases throughout. And when law enforcement doesn't call a wrong, that's where the boiling point comes from. Racism, whether it's African-American, Latino, against white, it doesn't matter. Law enforcement has to be unified. When we have people making decisions based on race, based on religion, that goes against everything America stands for. And when I say I can't agree with it, it's because I know it. We've disciplined people in our office that have crossed over racial lines. I have a guy in jail right now who committed a sexual assault while on duty. Police need to be held to a higher standard. And when you have law enforcement who have the power from the people violate that code, they need to be held to that standard. And if it becomes a racial issue, it's even that much more important. That's how we got here in the first place. And every police executive around the nation needs to recognize that. That's why I've said many times, George Floyd changed American policing, because we have to do things different. Recognize what's there. Listen to the people. That's what they want. They want change, and change comes by action.
Let me ask you one more thing. Sheriff Swanson, what is it like to be a police officer right now?
I love my job, and I love it in spite of all that's going on. I was just asked the question about all cops are bad, the acronym that's going around, and that breaks my heart. That part hurts, because we're not. We are the ones that you call when nothing else can help. And we don't ask. We just go. We have people that have given their lives on the way to calls, protect people they don't know. But you're always going to have folks that take away and detract from that. And that we have to continue to root out. If we ever forget that law enforcement is more than just traffic stops and 911 calls, but it's to serve people, then we have lost what the meaning of law enforcement is.
That is Chris Swanson, who's the sheriff of Genesee County, which includes the city of Flint, Michigan. And he walked with the protesters there in Flint when they were out in the streets. Chris Swanson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for doing what you do.
And at hereandnow.org, you can find more of our coverage of what has been going on, including an interview with the lead pastor at the church in Houston where George Floyd used to go. That pastor has provided us with some new photos of Floyd. That's all at hereandnow.org. Here in the U.S., COVID-19 has raged through nursing homes. The government said yesterday that 26,000 residents and nearly 500 staff have died so far in American nursing homes. Same story in the UK. During just 2 months this spring, 25,000 more people have died in English and Welsh nursing homes than would have under normal circumstances. NPR's London correspondent Frank Langfitt reports.
Heading into the pandemic, the British government worried a flood of coronavirus patients would cause its National Health Service to collapse. So hospitals began sending elderly patients back to the nursing homes where they lived. But the government didn't require testing for returning residents. Martin Green is the CEO of Care England, which represents nursing homes, or care homes as they're called here. Recently, he told a parliamentary committee what happened.
We also saw people being discharged from hospital, and we hadn't got the testing regime up and running. So despite what has been said, there were cases, I think, of people who were symptomatic, who were discharged into care homes.
Simply put, some nursing homes imported the coronavirus. Kathy Gardner thinks this led to the death of her father, Michael Gibson. Gibson, 88, passed away in early April with COVID-19 symptoms in a nursing home north of Oxford. Gardner, who has a doctorate in virology, thinks her dad contracted the disease from an upstairs neighbor who returned from the hospital and later died of COVID.
By emptying out hospitals to the point where we had lots of spare capacity, although that was good in many ways, the cost of that was to basically throw the elderly under a bus. I know some people have suggested that, well, you know, these people are old and sick and it doesn't really matter. If you want to allow one of your parents to die or a grandparent to die, that's fine, but you don't need to take mine.
Initially, the British government didn't seem to grasp the risks. Keir Starmer, leader of the opposition Labour Party, confronted Prime Minister Boris Johnson about the matter in the House of Commons.
Until the 12th of March, the government's own official advice was, and I'm quoting from it, "It remains very unlikely that people receiving care in a care home will become infected. Does the Prime Minister accept that the government was too slow to protect people?"
Prime Minister.
No, Mr. Speaker, it wasn't true that the advice said that, and actually...
In fact, the government did say that nursing home residents were very unlikely to contract the coronavirus. Again, Kathy Gardner.
I get very angry when I see the Prime Minister and others just making excuses or frankly, blatantly lying about what was happening.
Adelina Comas-Herrera is a health policy researcher at the London School of Economics. She said nursing homes often haven't had enough staff or personal protective gear.
We've actually had very few resources going into helping care homes fight the epidemic.
Comas-Herrera said countries in East Asia, which had experience with MERS or SARS, did far better.
In South Korea, there hasn't been a single death of a care home resident in the care home. That is because anybody with suspected COVID was immediately isolated, and if they tested positive, were removed into quarantine centers or hospitals.
British Health Secretary Matt Hancock says the government tried to throw what he called a protective ring around nursing homes and provided more than $5 billion to help them fight the coronavirus. But Kathy Gardner calls the government's efforts, quote, disgraceful. She adds, they fundamentally failed. Frank Langfitt, NPR News.
America braces for another night of protests. Last night, four officers in St. Louis were shot, and the police chief in Louisville, Kentucky, has been fired after a business owner was shot and killed there when police and the National Guard fired shots during some chaotic moments last night. And President Trump announced he would send the military to states where rioting needed to be quelled, despite calling himself an ally of all peaceful protesters. Yesterday, George Floyd's brother, Terrence, called for peace during a visit to the site where his brother died.
Now, what are y'all doing? What are y'all doing? Y'all doing nothing, because that's not going to bring my brother back at all.
And today on social media, people are sharing black screens in solidarity of what's being called Blackout Tuesday. Our next guest believes it's important at this moment to make the distinction that these are rebellions and not riots. Mark Lamont Hill is a political and cultural commentator and professor of media, cities, and solutions at Temple University. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And Mark, you say the term rebellion versus riot speaks to the political and organized dimension of this moment. Tell me more.
Yeah, you know, it's really important when we look at these uprisings around the country that we don't dismiss them as simply random violence or foolishness, that there's no political sense-making happening on behalf of the people doing the work out here in the field. These are political responses. These are not people after you win the Super Bowl and you tear your city down. These aren't people who have a wild party during spring break. These are people who are responding to structural injustice, and they're doing it through organized actions around the country. And I think it's important to highlight that. And it's not a respectability thing where, you know, if people are oppressed and they decide to occasionally engage in random acts, you know, I don't want to dismiss that either. But I think there's something more coordinated and interesting happening here that we lose sight of when we dismiss it as rioters. It also dehumanizes the people doing the actions here.
Let's talk about that a little bit more, because I've heard you say that if black people were to rebel every time there's a social injustice, we'd be doing nothing but rebelling. What do you feel is different about this particular moment?
I think there are a couple things. I think sometimes it's just a sense of collective exhaustion. In this case, for example, you know, you have the state neglecting its most vulnerable citizens with COVID-19 for months. And then people are home. They are drained both financially and emotionally. There's an extraordinary medical toll that's been taken on so many people. And then that's combined with the death, the killing of Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. And then we, you know, enjoying our Memorial Days or trying to. And you look and you see Christian Cooper being harassed at Central Park. And then you hear, you know, within hours about the death of George Floyd. And with each of those actions, there's a collective sense of we're vulnerable. We're subject to random violence. We're unprotected by the state. And we're have an increased likelihood of premature death. And when you see all of those things sort of occurring, it's easy for people to say we have had enough. The second piece of it, though, is the spectacle of it all. You know, when you see these things on video, when you see these things in full public view, I think it increases the pain and the sense of action. This is what happens when we see Mike Brown's body lay in Ferguson for 4.5 hours. It's what happens when we watch Rodney King get beaten by the LAPD. Watching it produces a different response in terms of the collective body politic responding to it.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit, though, about what justice would look like in this moment. You mentioned all of the incidents that have led up to this moment. In Georgia, even though it was several months later, there have been arrests for the killing of Ahmaud Arbery, that white woman in the New York City park calling for police on a black person was fired. There's an FBI investigation in the Breonna Taylor case. And then we know in Minneapolis that officer accused of killing George Floyd has been arrested and charged. And yet we are experiencing the biggest moment of civil unrest in recent history. What would justice look like in the immediate future?
It's a great question because in some ways it's an impossible question. Justice itself can never prevail at a moment where black people are subject to death on the streets, where random white citizens or law enforcement officers can take away our lives, you know, and act as judge, jury, and executioner. So because these people are dead, because Breonna Taylor is dead or Ahmaud Arbery is dead, there is no sense of justice, right? There's nothing just about that outcome. But what we can do is produce the best form of imperfect justice that we can. In the case of George Floyd, I think the arrest of the other officers is what most people on the streets are calling for. They're calling for accountability in other ways. Now, as an abolitionist, for me, the prison isn't the ultimate way that we should be imagining justice. But in the short term, the fact that there's no accountability for three people who watched him die is one of the reasons why you see this on the street. But the other thing here is it's important to say is that it's not a quid pro quo situation where, oh, if you arrest one more person, we'll stop being angry or we'll stop rebelling, because this isn't the product of one incident. Again, if black folk rebelled every time there was an injustice or a bad shoot or a wrongful incarceration or a wrongful death, we'd do nothing but rebel. This is about structural injustice over a period of time that begins when black folk arrive here in America. So the outrage you're going to see will be quelled some by greater moves toward justice. But you also have to, as they say in the hood, hold this L. You know, like we've been under enough pressure for so long that, you know, you're going to see some of it vent out.
At the same time, we're seeing our president threatened to deploy troops. He's talking about sending thousands and thousands of soldiers into cities. This kind of takes your description of rebellion to a whole new level.
Absolutely. And the president is being very careful or intentional, I should say. Care would not be a word I would use. He's being very intentional in the language that he's using. A week ago when he said, you know, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, he was intentionally invoking the exact language of the police chief of Miami, who was very unabashed in his commitment to using police brutality to quell young people from engaging in civil rights actions. So he's dog whistling to the white supremacist wing of his base as a way of getting a certain kind of commitment from the nation to use violent force against those who are rebelling. So now that he's calling in the force of the National Guard to quell resistance. Unfortunately, it saddens me, but it reminds me of the 50s and the 60s and those moments where civil rights actions were resisted through federal intervention in many ways. It's stunning to hear the president use that language, or it should be stunning to hear the president use that language. Of course, it's not, given what we've seen. But that's why this is a rebellion once again. The state is trying to push back. And it sends a message, finally, that the state would rather watch this country burn. This government would rather watch the nation burn in many ways than to simply yield justice for those who have been harmed.
You mentioned the 60s, the 50s, and the seismic uprising in the 60s, 67, 68, to be precise. What are the lessons that we can learn from those uprisings in this moment?
The lesson is when we fight, we win. You know, what we see in Detroit, for example, in 67, you know, there's a lesson in that. What we saw in 92 in L.A., there's a lesson in that. What we saw in Ferguson in 2014, there's a lesson in that. In each of those places, those battles on the ground led to concrete results. The conversation about body cameras, for example, regardless of how you feel about them, or civilian review boards, those emerge because of the struggles of 2014. In 2014, L.A. in 92 produced a conversation about police brutality that we simply have not seen otherwise. each of these moments creates something else, including the idea that if you want a peaceful alternative, a nonviolent alternative, then you have to learn to listen to the folk who are catching the most hell before we get to this point. So, you know, I don't want anyone on the ground or anyone watching the people on the ground to believe for a moment that these acts of resistance are for naught, that they're not yielding some sort of justice, some sort of fruit. They're not perfect. There are strategic and ethical choices we can make, and we can go back and forth about what's happening on the ground. But at the core, this is a principled, righteous resistance. This is a marvelous militancy that's going to lead to some real social change, I do believe.
Mark Lamont Hill is a political and cultural commentator and professor of media, cities, and solutions at Temple University. Mark, thank you so much.
Thank you.
As tensions between the U.S. and China continue to intensify over coronavirus blame and China's crackdown in Hong Kong, with some leaders on both sides even warning of a new Cold War, there's another issue simmering in the background, and that is Huawei, the Chinese telecom giant that hopes to spread 5G technology around the globe. Earlier this month, the U.S. raised the stakes in this years-long conflict by making it much harder for foreign companies to sell Huawei the silicon chips it needs. For more, let's bring in Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
And I guess we should start off, because this is one of these stories that we cover from time to time when there's news. But just to remind people, what is Huawei and why is the U.S. so worried about this company?
Right. So even though a lot of people in the U.S. don't think or talk about this company a lot, Huawei is massive. It doesn't just make smartphones, but it does make smartphones. And by the way, more smartphones than Apple. It is also the largest telecom equipment manufacturer in the world. And a big part of that business right now is the kits that help deploy 5G networks. Now, the thing to remember about 5G or fifth generation of cell networks is that it's higher speeds, but also way more nodes or antennas with information being transferred over shorter distances. And this is a really new telecommunications technology, and Huawei is one of the biggest players in the game right now, along with Swedish company Ericsson and Finnish company Nokia. In fact, Huawei is so far ahead on this technology that the U.S. and some of our allies are worried that this tech can be used to spy on us by China and let China do other nefarious stuff. But there hasn't been a ton of clarity about what to do about all of that, because they're the biggest player in the game and they seem to be the furthest along on making this new technology.
Well, and the U.S. strategy has been a big pressure campaign on European allies to try to get them, especially the United Kingdom, to stop buying Huawei's 5G technology, although that effort has largely failed. Now the U.S. is trying Plan B and going after Huawei's supply chain.
Yeah, that's right. A lot of these countries have direct relationships with Chinese companies in building this technology, so it's kind of hard for the U.S. to pressure even our allies to pass over Huawei as an option. The UK promised, for instance, that it would limit Huawei to controlling only 35% of traffic moving over new 5G networks and also some other security measures. But overall, this still kind of ends with Huawei dominating the global 5G game. And of course, to dominate the game, they rely on other tiny little computer components made by other companies, and U.S. tech firms are part of making those components. It's a little roundabout, but that's globalization for you, right? Earlier this month, the Trump administration pushed the Commerce Department to make it a lot harder for Huawei to build its new technology with the help of U.S. tech companies by saying that you basically need a license to sell to a company that sells its stuff to Huawei, which is all a roundabout way of saying, Jeremy, that in a globalized economy, global supply chains are present and the U.S. can disrupt things by dictating more and more which U.S. companies can do business with who.
Well, and they have disrupted that chain. Huawei's chairman has said that because of this move, Huawei is now in survival mode, which does make you wonder why the U.S. didn't try this tactic earlier.
Yeah, I guess it does. I mean, this has been a really long staring contest between the U.S. and China, and the stakes are high. But I think a lot of the stakeholders would like the stakes not to be higher. And that's part of why maybe this hasn't been done before. Doing what the Trump administration has done here takes things to another level. And that means we're now expecting retaliation, right? Which might happen because in part, we are now messing with a massive Chinese company's ability to do business around the world.
So what would Chinese retaliation look like?
Well, there are a lot of U.S. tech companies that do business in China, right? And that business is very important to those U.S. tech firms. There have been reports that the government might put a bunch of these companies, including Apple, Cisco Systems, Qualcomm, on a list as, quote, unreliable entities, which could lead to investigations, more restrictions of those companies doing business, regulations. Qualcomm, in particular, this U.S. tech company, has already been impacted by this kind of thing in China. The country might suspend buying Boeing airplanes. The list goes on. Again, in a globalized world, starting a trade war between a superpower and a rising superpower is pretty immediate casualties in trade and business.
So, Ben, just going back to where we started with this, where does all this leave the future of 5G?
Maybe in the further future, Jeremy. I mean, it's a good question, right? Without a doubt, if this impacts the ability of Huawei to roll out its products, it's going to impact the building and rolling out of 5G networks. But the last thing to remember, I think, is that we're in the middle of a global pandemic, and according to some economists, at the beginning of a massive economic disruption that could last for years. And at the end of the day, the future of 5G might hang in the balance, not because of this kind of trade battle, although that contributes to larger issues between the U.S. and China, but something much bigger, which is this disruption to the global economy. And both U.S. and Chinese tech companies might suffer from that, no matter who is allowed to buy chips from who.
That is Ben Brock Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Ben, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.